Today we are going to hear testimony in the order as listed, House Bill 2650, House Bill 3169, House Bill 3183, all of which will be public hearings. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2650, and before I ask Mr. Keller to give us a briefing, I will just give those of us in attendance a briefing. I think I've been remiss in not talking about our House Education Fund, which is solely funded by fees and assessments, also called taxes, for such things as the use of acronyms. I suppose you want change.
How about $5?
Use of acronyms, cell phones, please check them, and or timeliness. And as you can see, our committee is very, very attentive to the timeliness issue. So, with that, we will proceed. Mr. Keller, would you please give us some information about House Bill 2650?
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 2650 eliminates comparison of current year weighted average daily membership, ADMW, with prior year ADMW to calculate distributions under funding formulas for school districts and education service districts, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2005, and has a subsequent referral to revenue. And on your desk in front of you, there is a -1 amendment. And that's it.
Thank you very much. And so that our representative Wisnett might be able to move forward into his next committee, we'll ask him to come forward and give us your testimony, please. Permission to use a visual aid?
I request permission, Madam Chair, to use a visual aid.
Granted. Without objection.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, honorable members of this committee. It's my honor to testify in front of you today. It's a serious thing for me because I think what we want to do as representatives is do right for our children. Do what's right. During the interim, I served with your chair, Representative Flores, on the interim education committee, which you're now serving on. And I learned a lot. I learned about the school formula. I think that there's many in this building who do not understand that school formula. I'm sure that every member of this committee understands the school formula and how that important that is. That's what allocates our $8 billion education budget to each school district, almost $9 billion education budget. During the interim, we learned about weighted students. And we learned about remote schools, small schools, and we also learned about declining enrollment. And as you've been told during your presentations, I'm sure, that school distribution formula was created in 1991 to try to provide equal funding to all of our children throughout our unique state. A unique state where one school district in my county has three students, that we spend $47,000 per student. But we have 198 school districts in our state, and we try to provide equal funding to each of those children through this formula. When the formula was created in 1991, we had very few school districts that had declining enrollment. Very few. I think that the data presented to me was that the first 2 years there was no schools with declining enrollment. Today, committee members and Madam Chair, 67% of our school districts have declining enrollment. 67%. It's not a unique situation. The unique situation may be those school districts that have tremendous growth. And the school distribution formula, when it was set up to help those declining enrollment schools, was because that was a unique. It wasn't the norm. And now it's become more than the norm. Today, we're spending about $58 million per year for these students. It's $116 million for the biennium. And this information was provided to me by ODE. The small amount for each school district, there's the numbers, I think, of course, Portland School has 3,000, but outside of Portland, the numbers are in the hundreds. It equals a total of 11,000 total declining enrollment numbers in 2005 for the entire Oregon School District. I don't think this is fair. I don't think it's fair to the students that are not phantom students that are sitting in the classroom. And I don't think it prejudices or is disadvantaged to the small rural schools. As I said, the school district with the largest number of declining enrollment is Portland School District. It has 3,000. Members of this committee and Madam Chair, if we enacted this bill, we could add $100, $100 per student per year from the school distribution formula. Now, let me tell you this. You know very well about the weighted formula. I put in my notes that you have, it's not my complete testimony, but some notes for your review, that the way the system is designed now, if we have a young lady who is pregnant in the school system, she counts as two people. So if you have a declining enrollment, she's not there in the next school year, you're paying for two people that aren't there. Not one, two. If you had two students, you're paying for four students that aren't there. So I think this needs to be changed. I don't know what's fair. I would ask the committee that I have briefed this to my caucus, and to be honest, was not overwhelmingly in support. But I think it's the right thing to do, and that's why I'm here to ask this committee to at least consider a work group to look at this aspect of the school distribution formula. I think it's important to change. $116 million. $100 per student. That's too much not to consider it as important. Now, I do have an amendment that was provided to me, and I'm willing to... I don't know if you have that, Madam Chair. You do have the amendment. Mm-hmm. This amendment would create what's called a declining enrollment grant to really help those schools with a declining enrollment of 10% or more. Now, we can talk about that, and the work group could decide that however you want to do that. I've also provided you a chart that shows how many schools actually have 10% declining, 7.5, and 5.5. So it's not out of 198 school districts, if you include all the way down to 5%, you're still going to save some money. I think that... I've been advised that 17 school districts that had a percentage decline of 10% or greater, but OD's has indicated that there's still approximately $112 million paid out in all school districts. Okay, that's what we're doing. If we were to move the declining enrollment element from the school distribution formula, one-fourth or 29 million of that 112, I've been telling you 117, now the 116, now OD's telling us that we have 112. But one-fourth of that would be $29 million, which we could set aside in a grant to help those schools with the declining enrollment. But again, as a minimum, I think we ought to look at using actual numbers and not weighted students. Now, we don't have him here, but this could be two people here instead of one if we use weighted. So there is some savings to be gained here and still be fair to compassionate to those schools that are having decline enrollment. So the amendment you have says that we would only do it, we would only reward it to those with 10% or more. An alternative that the work group could look at would be going to 7% or 5%. I have a comment that was presented by Mr. Reeder, who I think is in the audience. He stated the purpose of the declining enrollment is to give added resources to declining enrollment districts since certain costs are fixed and don't decline when enrollment declines. But his written outline indicates that the need for additional resources in the decline is not based upon a cost analysis. So we don't really know that. And my friend and your colleague, Representative Dallum, it tried to explain to me how the declining enrollment, he needed that time to get rid of a teacher or to consolidate a class, but he even admitted to me that maybe it doesn't take that long. So I hope I'm not misquoting my friend, Representative Dallin. But, Madam Chair, that completes my testimony. I would welcome questions, and I would also encourage this committee to form a work group that we really look at this. I think it's too much money that we cannot continue to do this, $116 million or $112 million in declining enrollment.
Thank you, Representative Wisnett. Are there questions for Representative?
Thank you, Representative Wisnett. It's always a challenge dealing with these issues, and I've got I don't have, these aren't the most current, I assume, because we don't have a total like you've given us. And so one of the things I'd like to see is what, based on, say, this school year's enrollment, what would be the net effect of either one of these. But it is something that we should look at, consider. And at the same time, I was thinking, for example, if I noticed on here one of your, I believe it's your district, Brothers, they had a decline of 50%. Of course, they're very small to begin with, but and so that probably didn't affect their because they're protected. I mean, they only have one teacher anyhow. But in a district where they're planning for, say, 100% enrollment again of what they had the previous year, and all of a sudden they've got 95%. What happens with all those teachers that they've already got a contract with who show up at the door ready to teach, and there are fewer students? How do you take care of those situations? And I think that's what that weighted the alternative method was designed for, is to take care of that problem. Do you have any solution for that?
Madam Chair, Representative Marsh, I think we would have to address the Brothers situation. As I stated, that school district gets $47,000 per student, not considering declining enrollment, but that's what they're being paid. A lot of that's transportation and the remoteness of them. As far as the teachers that are hired, that's what Representative Dallum tried to explain to me, that he has, as a school superintendent, school principal, he has to have teachers there, and it's not that quick. And again, when I first presented this bill, I was saying that I would be willing to try to say maybe we reduce it to 1 year or something like that. But the bill, the way it is structured now, it goes on forever. So my point, so if a school district keeps going down, you're continuously getting the higher amount. You know, you're not back to zero, to the first step, but you're stepping down. So you're still going to be getting more and more money. And I think that at a certain point, just as Superintendent Phillips had to make in Portland, that sometimes the decision is not what we want to, but you have to look at closing the school. It's not economical. And I think I would also comment to Representative Marsh that the school the declining enrollment grant is how you would be able to help that. Those people would come in and say, we've got a problem. We've got 10 teachers that I can't, you know. So that year I'm going to have only 20 in my class. That's good.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Rublin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions. And we've talked a little bit about this. I come from one of those districts where we've had declining enrollment. And I would rather you use the word equitable distribution of money as opposed to equal. Because in our system, there is nothing that's equal. There are equitable ways of doing it. And I think it's important because, you know, one of the things that people would say to me about equal is that Portland taxpayers pay more money into the system than they get out for their students. And some of those of us who live outside of that area, because they are trying to make it equitable so that all kids can have an education, get some of their money that they're paying in, because we don't have enough people and income coming in to balance it out. So we put a whole group of people together and we built this very complex system, one part of that system was this whole idea. And so I guess what I'm asking about is to think about equitable when we're doing it as opposed to just the equal, because I think if you go equal, there's a whole lot of things that are not equal in the system. The hope is that it's the most equitable system that takes into consideration things like what Superintendent Dolan was concerned about balancing it, because there was an issue about having it balanced over 3 years as opposed to just one, because of that kind of thing. And the other thing is that I think sometimes when we talk about it, you are getting less money each year. It's just that it ameliorates it a little bit, because if you're continuing to decline, say I decline 100 this year, I get to keep that for next year. I can decline another 50. I lose the 100, but I get the 50. So it's not that it's cumulative. It's just one, every year you're a little bit behind. But the teachers don't leave, and I guess I'm more not really asking a question other than the equitable part.
Oh, I wondered if there was a pony in there. Sorry.
Okay. But I hope you'll say it.
Were there any other questions for Representative Wisnett, Representative Dahl?
Yes, Representative Wisnett, when you were doing the research, did you come to a figure statewide on dollar per ADM in the formula and the direction that it has gone in the last four or five bienniums? Let's do it that way.
Madam Chair, Representative Dallin, from my research and my attendance on all the interim committees and the Ways and Means committees, the total funding for students has gone up. Maybe, and that's in current dollars, it has gone up. I'm not sure if you're talking about just in those declining enrollment schools or...
No, what I'm trying to dig out is, I think that Representative Wisnott has something to say here. And he points out several things. The funding per student has gone up appreciably since this formula was initiated. And so when we pay people for students they don't have, and we took care of that in 1991. We are now not paying schools for students they do have, and we have to look at that. And I think that's where I was going. We're paying more per ADM. We need more per ADM, and those with increasing enrollment, and even though it's only 33% of our schools, are not getting paid for the students they have. So we need a bump in the formula if you have rapid growth or something like that. And I think Representative Wisnott has pointed out an issue that if we're going to remain equitable, that we must address.
Madam Chair, Representative Dowd, thank you very much. And that was, you spoke that correctly, and I appreciate those comments. But again, I think I would agree with you completely. But that's why I think that this, we need to look at this formula. And I think there's so much money we said here. How would we come up with some way to change it to treat those high growth areas or to help those districts with declining enrollment? And it just doesn't make any sense. As a minimum, I hope this committee would say that if we're going to continue to reward declining enrollment, that we would look at real students and not weighted students. You know, go back to the number. I mean, that doesn't make sense. The teacher is she's not teaching the two persons that the young lady who's pregnant is. She's teaching, you know, she lost one. So, because as you know and I know, our weighted amount of money does not go directly towards providing those services for those children. It goes in the general fund too, in the school fund, the big pot. It does not go to help that lady specific, or to help English as a second language or someone. We have not been able to track that. It just goes into the big pot and goes out. So I realize this is a difficult issue. I would appreciate the committee at least looking at a work group to say we can save some money, because, again, as Representative Dallum says, what we're trying to do is provide more money for the students in the classroom. It's a tough job, and I appreciate your time and efforts in doing that. And I would appreciate your consideration of some of this bill with some amendments that we could look at some way to be sure we're funding those students that are in the chair and not the phantom students.
Everybody okay? Questions? Addressed? Thank you. Thank you very much, Representative Wisnett. I am going to move forward with other testimony on this bill, but we will be talking about a work group. So.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Peter Tarzian. Do I mispronounce that every time? Before you begin,
Madam
I'd
Chair.
Like to welcome our honorary pages here today, and one of my specifically hosted pages. So welcome y'all.
And mine as well.
And Representative Marches. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of this committee, my name is Peter Tarzian. I'm superintendent of schools in Falls City, Oregon, and I'm also the legislative chair of the Oregon Small Schools Association. I'm here to express our membership's concerns about House Bill 2650 as it's currently drafted. Because of technical problems, we believe that it presents for school districts. Although we appreciate the legislators' apparent desire to fund schools based on current enrollment, and if we understand the legislation, we think we do, but we're not exactly sure that we do, we think that the problems are fairly substantial. Current budget law and personnel statutes require that we establish our staffing levels well in advance of the beginning of any particular school year. In reality, large district or small, we are planning for programs and staff by the end of the first quarter of any school year and do so based on current enrollment and certification requirements at all grade levels. The general practice is to anticipate the same or slightly fewer students based on current demographic trends for our communities for the subsequent year. Without the current formula's look-back provision, we would be planning and making contractual commitments based on really unknown resources. As a practical matter, if our enrollment drops, and I understand that this bill's seems to be driven by discussion about declining enrollment and ghost students. If our enrollment drops in a subsequent year, because of the planning and the statutory commitments that we've made to our contractual staff, what we do is we move forward with funding that supports the staffing levels and the program levels that we've anticipated in the previous budgeting cycle. We also trim where we can, quite obviously, because if we begin to see declining enrollment, we know from the way in which the current formula works that in the subsequent year to that declining enrollment year, unless we have increased enrollment, we in fact will be having a major problem because we will then be being reimbursed by the higher of the 2 years, and if that were to flatten out, then suddenly if we didn't trim, if we didn't try to put some money aside, we wouldn't be able to meet our program requirements. What I've done is I've provided, I assume you have testimony, I've provided you with let's see, how much is the fine for the pot? ADM snapshot by quarter? Or do you fine us? With a snapshot of the quarter by quarter for Falls City School District. These numbers are small because Falls City School District is a small district. As you can see, currently we're projecting about 180. Now, this is not weighted ADM. This is just ADMR. This is raw students. But membership, not enrollment. You can see that in 03-04, we had a dip down to 173.5. In 02-03, we were at 182.3. Now, the way the funding formula currently works, what it allowed me to do, and by the way, I'm the business manager for the school district as well as the superintendent as well as the principal of the high school, what it allowed me to do was to capture enough money to maintain my program levels in this dipped year. That's the way the current formula works. And so if there's a change in the formula, and I happen to be a person, sometimes not very popular, who amongst my colleagues, who says, well, why do we have to do it this way? And I would suggest to you that, in fact, it's a very complex issue, especially when you get involved with the weighted student issue. That's always worth looking at, because what the legislature is doing at this point is assuming responsibility for funding public education as a result of Measure 5, passed over a decade and a half ago, longer than that. At any rate, another problem that I think would be posed for the state if you were to adopt this legislation as it's currently drafted would be that you would eliminate the look-back provision in the formula that is really supported by ODE's certification process of weighted data. A particular problem for many districts is the special education count and the 11% cap. Just to give you a view, there is currently a 16-month lag between the time a district special education count is submitted by the school district and additional weightings are awarded to what then becomes the previous year's final certified ADMW. This lag many times results in the state adjusting its payments to districts that were based on the current year estimate to the previous year estimate. That's the way that it works. I would suggest to you that this reporting and certification lag time will, as the state gets more and more involved, exist for ELL students, for small and remote school corrections, for local tax revenue corrections based, in other words, the actual collections versus what is projected. And the list kind of goes on and on. So to summarize, the problem that I think you face when you want to change the way in which the formula is currently structured is that the personnel and planning requirements that for the same school districts that you're talking about would be really compromised and would kind of run afoul of state law without then changing a lot of other parts of the statute as well. And I would suggest to you that that's a very complex issue, and I guess I would recommend that if there is a need to look at this, then the representative suggestion for a work group or even a possible interim committee to look at the way in which the funding formula is working for both your small as well as your large school districts would be in order. I'm open to any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Dr. Tarzan?
Thank you very much.
You get an A today. Thank you. I'd like to call John Marshall, Kent Hudziker, and Matt Markey.
You can lead off. There you go.
You can flip a coin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here to talk about this bill. When you look at the bill that,
for the
that
record,
applies
please.
Here. Oh, yeah, excuse me. My name is Kent Hunsaker, and I'm the executive director of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and I live here in Salem. When you look at this bill, the declining enrollment factor in the state school fund formula, I view as one of the most important aspects of the formula, and I'll tell you why. I hear talk about phantom students, but the reality is that in this state, and what I passed around to you is the enrollment for the past 5 years of all the school districts in the state. And you'll notice that about two-thirds of those districts have negative numbers by them. If it was as simple as when you start a year and you have 30 less kids, that you could eliminate a teacher and take care of the problem, we wouldn't probably be here today. But when you take 30 times 5,000, that's 150,000. If a district makes plans and employs teachers and then was to find out that their enrollment was down, they wouldn't have to cut a teacher. Teachers are worth about $50,000. They'd have to cut three teachers or other aspects of the program in the middle of the year. And that's exactly what this provision in the funding formula does, is protects districts from making plans and not having to go beyond. On the other side of that, I happen to be in the Bethel School District for 17 years. And for 16 of those years, our enrollment gained. And if you look at Bethel on here, it's down about 5,573, so you can kind of see it on the column. You'll notice that in 03-04 was the very first year in 16 years that the Bethel School District's enrollment declined. How did they know it was going to decline? They had no idea that it was going to decline. It was an all-of-a-sudden kind of thing. They made plans for the budget. They got 100 less kids than what they normally had, and probably more kids than that because they projected an increase rather than a decline. So in that year, 100 times $5,000, $500,000 that they would have had to, in the middle of the year, reduce out of their budget if they hadn't been able to go back and do the other. So it adds some stability to some of these districts that do not know and cannot predict what their enrollment is going to be. It is extremely critical factor in the formula. And to call these students phantom students, I guess, is to me, it just doesn't fit, because what it does and what this aspect of the formula does is protect districts as they make plans and be able to carry those through and then be able to have a year to plan ahead to be able to make those reductions. It's extremely important. If there was real interest in doing this and our districts were to hear about it, you would have this room filled up with school districts that would be drastically affected by this. I'll take the final example I give right now is Portland. You'll notice that Portland's enrollment last year declined by 1,600 kids. That's $8 million. You know that Portland is currently cutting $35 million. Add $8 million to that. If this factor was not there, they would be at 43. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hold our questions for the panel to complete.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Equity Steering Committee, which is a group of seven school districts from across the state that we represent as a whole, rather than on an individual basis. And we focus on the equitable distribution of the state school fund mainly. You've heard a lot from the proponents of this bill today about adding dollars adding money to the funding of our school system. I just want to be clear that this bill does not add any money to the total pot of the K-12 school system, but rather just shifts how that money gets distributed. The provisions of the funding formula that we're talking about here today were set up to help districts that are losing students but weren't able to cut overhead for the amount of money that they're losing. And I don't want to take a lot of time today, but I do want to give one example. If you take a district like Lincoln County, which is a countywide district and has about 25 buildings spread out across the county, if a district like that loses 100 students, that's about $500,000 that they're losing out of their budget in a year. However, that's only about 4 students per building. And it's very difficult to try and cut $500,000 out of a budget when we're only talking about 4 students being lost out of each building. The members, or the school districts that are comprised of our group, some of them are growing, some of them are declining, and all of the districts that are growing districts in our group say that it's a lot easier problem to deal with growing students than it is with declining. It's always easier to budget when you have more additional dollars coming in rather than a dollars coming out of your budget. And while all of these districts that are growing, you know, appreciate additional funds to their district, they also realize that when it comes at the expense of other districts, especially at a time of economic hardship in our economy right now, this bill probably just isn't the best idea. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. And I guess I'm one of the sole remaining survivors of the work group that created the state school fund distribution formula back in 1991. There was a lot of subjective decision making that went on in creating the formula and the weightings, and frankly, not a lot of science. We were using a lot of estimates. I agree with Representative Wisnant that it's probably a good opportunity to take a look at the formula, take a look at the weightings, and try to determine if they accurately reflect what they were intended to do, and that is to create a rational basis on which to allocate $7 billion now over a biennium to 198 school districts. So I think it's probably time to take the time to look at those factors and see if there's more science now that we have better data, better ability to gather the data, whether those factors are fulfilling the function for which they were originally intended. The reasons for the calculation of extended weighted ADMW, excuse me, I owe a dollar, average daily membership, as has been stated, to give school districts an opportunity to make adjustments, because when students leave a school district, they don't leave in compact, neat little packages. For example, a school district going through declining enrollment doesn't see all their third graders, for example, leave in 1 year, where they may be able to make some significant adjustments in terms of staff reductions and so forth. As Matt suggested, they leave in little pieces, so it's very difficult to reduce your overhead concurrent with the number of students that leave. Again, I think it's probably time to take a look at the formula, and we'd certainly be willing to engage in any discussion that may go on the rest of this legislative session or during the interim to take a look at the formula and see if there's not a better way to do it. I will caution you, however, that in the age of computers, that any change to the formula produces a computer simulation, which shows here's the column with each of your individual school districts and what they're getting under current law. Next to it is a column that shows what your school district would get with the change proposed, and the final and most important column shows the winners and losers. And not that anybody on this committee would do this, but I have seen legislators look at that final column and make decisions about whether or not the funding formula change is a good one based on whether there are particular school districts win or lose. And so the politics of trying to make significant change to the formula are very, very difficult. But again, I think it's time we probably take a look at it, and we would welcome that opportunity and look forward to engage in that discussion with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall. I will ask if there are any questions. I will make the comment just in regard to your last very colorful analogy somewhat, that there are also members, administrators, probably people with whom you've worked, who also know how to do the hydraulics on those numbers and come out with something to their advantage and make themselves winners. Representative Farr.
Thank you. This question is for Mr. Marshall. Can you tell me, since you were part of the group that came up with the new state school distribution formula, how was the distribution formula determined prior to 1991?
Representative Farr, Madam Chair, the prior to 1991, prior to 1990 and the passage of Ballot Measure 5, school districts were primarily reliant on local property taxes. And the level of property taxes, for example, per student varied widely depending on property wealth, the amount of school dollars that could be raised per $1 of assessed value, and so forth. So the disparities were very broad. I can remember seeing data that school district spending for student ranged from $2,000 or $3,000 up to $20,000 or $30,000. The disparities were just that broad. And tax rates for schools per $1,000 of assessed value ranged from a low of $2 or $3 up to over $35 per thousand to fund schools. So there were very wide disparities, and because the bulk of the funding came from local property taxes, some school districts were very successful for a variety of reasons in getting property tax levies and tax bases approved by their local voters, and others weren't. The state funds that provided really probably 25% to 30% of the total school funding pot, part of that allocation was made to create some small portion of equalization. Most of it went out to school districts on a per student basis.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And then going back to what the good Representative Roblin said regarding equal or equitable distribution, it seems that what happened was we were seeing inequitable distribution, really, because you were looking at the wealthier districts and the schools had more money to spend, better programs. The poorer districts, which would include many of the schools in my district, mm-hmm. Former Superintendent Hunsicker knows all about that since he was superintendent for 17 years, just didn't have the money to spend per student that the wealthier districts had.
Mm-hmm.
So really, I mean, the purpose of your distribution formula was to make it equitable.
Representative Farr, I've tried to look at the formula and use the term equalization because I think what we're doing is equalizing dollars. And I think the issue of equity, for example, equity of program for students is a different issue. And one could argue that while we equalize dollars, there's still an equity question in terms of the program offerings for students in varying school districts. So, yes, we've equalized resources, but the larger equity question, I think, is still unanswered.
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And probably, Mr. Marshall, you're probably the one to ask this. I see the concept of why the measure was the formula was put together in that you're planning a year ahead, basically. Of course, we're planning 2 years ahead or more. But how does the money come in? Say a district is gaining students, and they come in significantly higher. At what they don't know that until September. Say, when does that get reported, and when does the money actually start flowing in on their higher ADMW?
Madam Chair, Representative March, I think I can answer your question, and I hope Brian Reeder from the Department of Education is back there that can correct me if I go astray. Right now, school districts, he may think I already have. School districts right now are turning in estimates to the Department of Education on their expected enrollment for next year. Starting in after the first of the fiscal year, after July 1, the department will start making distributions out to school districts from the state school fund based on those estimates. There will be a mid-year correction, that is on December 31, the department will take a snapshot of that school district. And they will compare the estimates the school district turned in versus the data that the department receives from a sort of an actual, for lack of a better term, body count on December 31st. In May, they'll make an adjustment. If the school district's enrollment was higher than anticipated, if it was higher than they estimated, that May adjustment will produce more dollars for that school district. If it was less than what they estimated, that May adjustment will adjust downward. The following May, once the department receives the audits from the school districts and they have the final numbers for this next school year, this would be May of 07, they will make a further adjustment for the actual audited data from that school year.
So, follow up. So in actuality, we're always trending and averaging the funds to provide a certain amount of smoothness in the cash flow over a period of time.
That's correct. And it also, if school districts know that in May of the current year, as well as May of the following year, they're going to get an adjustment up or down, they're going to do the best they can to make sure that the estimates they turn in are as close to being accurate as possible. Now, there are obviously opportunities for gains, but that will ultimately catch up with them.
Thank you.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure probably any of you can answer this question, but how are the districts in Ontario and Pendleton, places that have prisons, how are they doing on enrollment in schools? Do you have any sense of that? I'm not sure which districts cover those areas.
Pendleton should be Pendleton?
Well, Pendleton should be on the
yeah.
Pendleton is about two-thirds of the way down.
Representative Shields, Madam Chair. Pendleton is about two-thirds of the way down on the first page. And it looks like they've declined in enrollment about 8% over the last 5 years. Ontario is just below that, and Ontario has grown slightly over the last 5 years, 2.5%.
Representative,
I just...
Oh, sorry.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chair. And a couple of weeks ago, we heard the testimony from the chalkboard presentation, and the idea has been floated that the enrollment versus attendance. And can you comment on it instead of talking about the weighted students, 10% more or less? The practical idea was counting the attendance, and we give actually funding to the number of attendance instead of enrollment. Can you give us some comment on it?
I'd be happy to comment on that, Representative Lim, Madam Chair. There are numerous states that do, by numerous, I know there are some states that actually do funding based on attendance rather than the number of students that are enrolled. The idea behind that would be it would naturally encourage students to be at school and also maybe provide more encouragement for school districts to have students in school. However, the other side of that is that if you want to look at attendance rates, again, you get into what kinds of students will attend school more, and if you want to look at districts, it's probably the case that there is lower attendance in some districts because of the makeup of that district, and so you have to be careful that you're likely to punish some areas that that might have some lower enrollment based on the makeup of the population in that district, and that would be the effect. Now, it could also be assumed that an area like that would have lower attendance could spur that up. But there are just, I mean, that's what would happen, is that there are places that would get more money and less money based on that. And it could encourage some attendance. I haven't seen any studies on it. But the effect would be that there would be some districts hurt that have, because of their makeup, students attending less.
All right, follow up.
Follow up.
And I'm not sure what you mean by makeups, and please explain that.
Yeah. The thinking is that if you were to take an inner city school, where you have a variety of issues in that school with families and so on, families on welfare, families that are where the mother and father are not together. There's all kinds of issues in some of the lower income areas that might be in a school district, that they have bigger issues with getting their kids to school on a regular basis, and that because of that makeup of that population, that you might be punishing them in terms of the money you would provide to them.
Are you considering also the ethnicity?
I would think more of income and the number of one parent families and the issues that could go along. So if you have a makeup of in a school or in a district that is real heavy in that, you're probably going to naturally have a lower attendance pattern than you might have where you've got families with both parents at home, real solid in terms of income and those types of things. That's just a bit of a reality, and I don't know that ethnicity has anything to do with it, but I think income may, and I haven't again seen any studies, but I believe that would be that if you went through and looked at it, your lower attendance is going to be by lower income areas in the state.
Thank you.
Representative March, you had another comment?
Yes, actually, question and an aside. I just mentioned that Pendleton did pass a local option recently. So, but the question was, with regard to Dr. Tarzian mentioned that one of the areas that we should probably look at was the special education and 11% cap. Any comments on that particular issue and the formula?
Representative March, Madam Chair. I've served on the 11% cap committee since its inception, so I'm very familiar with that process. We have a kind of an interesting situation right now because as you look at special education, there's a variety of pieces of the funding formula that apply to that. One is the double weighting. One is the high-cost disability fund. And the third is the application for students above the 11%, the 11% cap. Strangely, as you look at the high-cost disability funds, those are paid in the same year. Estimates are made and payments are made, and then they are corrected the following year based on audits. The 11% cap, though, does not pay until a full year after the students have gone through. So it's very different. It actually is one that I believe the same thing could be done. You could do estimates on the amount of money that would be spent. You could actually do some calculations and have it paid in the same year and make the adjustment. But it is the one piece of the formula that goes until the following May. So as you look at 03-04, that will be settled in May of this year. So we go back. It's not going to be settled until this May. And those 11% cap students have been applied for, and districts have probably got noticed in the last couple of weeks. I think Brian Reeder or somebody in that department would know exactly when it is. But they just got noticed as to how many kids were approved. So it's a full year after. And it is a complicating piece. But, you did it with the high-cost disability fund. It's paid in the same year now based on estimates, and the 11% cap differs from that.
Representative Don.
Yes, I'm not sure whether I want to talk to Mr. Hunsinger or Mr. Marshall, but when tweaks in the formula are made, how long does it take for that information to get off the House floor and out to the schools? And how long does it take them to respond to you?
Representative Dallum, Madam Chair, I remember, I'm going to tell a story now. In the first legislative session in developing the formula, there were all kinds of ideas floating around. And each of the different ideas, there would be a computer simulation with a number on it. And those were circulated almost immediately. I mean, the advocacy organizations, the Oregon Education Association, the school administrators, the school boards association, I mean, we'd fax those out because everybody wanted to know what's the latest. And so it became a debate that your offices would get calls and say, we support Run 52, but we really don't like Run 36. And so it doesn't take very long. I mean, obviously, right now, school districts are convening budget committees. They're beginning to think about getting their budgets put together for the next school year, and they're very anxious, not only about what the final appropriation is going to be, but any changes to the distribution formula that would affect that particular school district share of the state school fund. So there's a lot of anxiety, and it doesn't take long for the information to get out.
Thank you.
But perhaps a better question might be, have there ever been any tweaks since the 1991 implementation of the school distribution formula?
Well, Madam Chair, yes, there have. From memory, the facilities grant has been added. The small school supplement fund, the high cost disabilities grant, and in fact I don't believe the extended ADMW component that we're talking about today was a part of the original formula. So there have been changes. I would suggest they've been relatively minor. And for example, 2 years ago, the change made to the formula which added the small school supplement fund and the high cost disabilities grant were packaged together because it provided a balance. If you had done if we had done the small school grant separately, then that would have caused a shift of money from every school district to small schools. If we'd have done the high cost disabilities grant by itself, that would have shifted money from a lot of school districts to those with a higher proportion of those high cost special needs students. So it was done together to sort of balance that out, so there was a little bit of something in the formula change for everybody.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, the other change was the change in transportation.
That's right.
Transportation used to be at 70% period, and the previous session it was changed to 70, 80, 90, based on top 20% of the districts getting 80 or 90.
Thank you. Did you have another question?
One more for Mr. Marshall. When the formula was first put together, John, how long was the committee engaged from start to finish in putting that formula together? Was it years, months, days, weeks?
Representative Down, it was months. The committee talked, and then a work group met. There was a decision to get some advice, so an individual, an expert on school funding and school funding litigation from the National Conference of State Legislatures, a gentleman by the name of John Augenblick, was retained and came and gave the committee some advice. And as I said, there was a work group with all the stakeholders that looked at all the various aspects and options, and so it was not a, it was a drawn out process that involved a lot of folks and a lot of input. But it extended over the course of several months.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. I do want to escalate our pace just a little bit, but I would like to offer Brian Reeder, would you like to come forward and make some comments on this issue or defend your name?
Chair Flores, members of the committee, I'm Brian Reeder. I'm with the Department of Education. Very briefly, the department has not taken a position on this bill. I think as Representative Wisnett indicated, this is a very difficult problem. We heard from a lot of districts that when they're in a declining enrollment situation, they have fixed costs that don't go away as those students depart. We've also heard from rapidly growing districts that they have exceptional costs that are caused by growth. The reality is that we don't have any good studies that have looked at how costs are affected by either declining enrollment or rapidly growing enrollment. So, given that sort of lack of information, the department didn't feel we were in a position to either support or oppose this. As Representative Wisnett indicated, it does move around a certain amount of money, roughly $58 million a year, from growing districts to declining districts, and this bill would reverse it would stop that flow, leave that money with the growing districts and take it away from the declining districts. So that is the issue before you. Unfortunately, we don't have any guidance to give you at this point.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Reeder? Thank you very much for making yourself available. For the committee's information and also for the record, I would just like to make reference and read into the record a couple of comments from our interim committee final report. Issues raised by the committee in regard to the school distribution formula. Number one, is it time to review the student weights? Two, review the funding method for school districts with declining enrollments? Three, is it time to ensure schools are obtaining the desired results based on funding? Four, report revenue per student on a consistent basis to include all revenue sources? Five, is it time to review teacher experience weight? Now, the background of this was some report work. The state school fund distribution formula, time for a change. September 2000 states in part on page 14, is change needed? This is the question that arose during the 1999 legislative session. Because of the focus on total funding levels and the time constraints inherent in a legislative session, the question was deferred for further study. The Equity Funding Panel report of the 2002 QEM report under the Executive Summary of Recommendations, item number 8, states in part, more is known today than was known when the weights were created in 1991. When the formula was created, we did not have performance-based goals to review the outcomes against. The state should examine each weight category to look for the research-based support for the weight. In November 2003, the Secretary of State conducted a risk assessment for ODE. Under General Risks, Item 2, it states, state school fund money may not be used as intended. Background, department management has acknowledged that there has not been ample accountability for the ways in which state school funds have been used, including K-12 formula funding. Management indicated that the department could do more to monitor district slash school use of this funding. Potential mitigating actions: monitor the use of state school funds to ensure that it is efficient and effective. The committee, interim committee, recommends the 2005 Legislative Assembly examine ORS 327.013 and ORS 336.640 and examine each weight category to look for research-based support for the weight as recommended by the 2002 QEM and determine if ODE has responded to the risk assessment to the State School Fund as reported by the Secretary of State Office. The phantom student issue, ORS 327.013, print 6, must be addressed by the 2005 Legislative Assembly. With those thoughts and with the testimony that we have heard, I would like to have Mr. Keller convene a panel for a work group to meet, and then we will most likely move this into an interim project. But Representative Wisnett, I know, so a representative from... may I be free to use acronyms? OSBA and COSA, ODE, and Representative Dahlem. Anyone else would like to, and Representative Roblin.
I'd be interested.
And Shields.
I would be interested in it.
And Representative Wynn.
I would like to.
And Representative.
Want to have a quick meeting?
We won't have a quorum.
Yeah, that's your. Just ran into a quorum there.
We'll work it out.
Well, Madam Chair, my main concern is that somebody from the Portland area will be involved.
We understand. Thank you very much, and we'll take that into consideration. So we'll accommodate that, and with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2650.
Somebody stand outside.
Madam
exactly,
Chair,
yes.
May I also suggest that someone from OEA be involved in the process
of course.
As well?
Yes. And OEA. There we go. Do I need to public hearing that in? I think it's for the record. Thank you very much. We'll have a public hearing now on House Bill 3169. Thank you. Mr. Keller, would you give us a rundown?
House Bill 3169 requires school districts, education service districts, and public charter school employees to report suspected child abuse by district employee to supervisor or other designated person. Requires districts and schools to investigate reports and complaints of child abuse. Requires districts and schools to keep records of investigations. Direct districts and schools to disclose records of investigations of complaints that are substantiated. Directs districts and schools to provide records to law enforcement agencies, Department of Human Services, and Teacher Standards and Practice Commission. Declares an emergency effective July 1, 2005. There is no referral, and we do have one amendment.
Okay. We distributed the amendment.
No, I don't have the amendment.
No. Well, wait. It's just the same thing.
We'll get that amendment distributed. Okay, and I have. Vicki Chamberlain and Susan, is that Nisbet?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Vicki Chamberlain, Executive Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and with me is our investigator, Susan Nisbet. We were invited to come and talk to you about House Bill 3169. I think you're probably running a little short on time today, so I'm going to be brief. I provided some background information, and I am going to walk you through what we brought and shorten what I had intended to say. But attached to my testimony is a table on long form that gives you a little bit of background. I thought it would be interesting to go back over the last 4 years and look at all our discipline cases and look specifically at the cases that had to do with educators and conduct with students, and that would range from inappropriate comments to inappropriate touching. And the vast majority of the cases in the very middle of the grid, you'll see it says number of revocations and suspensions related to sex crimes or inappropriate conduct with students. The vast majority of those are licensure revocations. And of the total of all those people, I went back and looked, which include a couple of reprimands. There are only 3 active licenses, and 2 of which I know of are employed. And the reprimands were fairly mild. One of them was a failure to, well, actually, one of them was a reprimand for interfering with the sexual abuse investigation by law enforcement, which is a little issue, I think, that's presented here by this bill. I also thought it was interesting to note, if you look at the far right-hand column, what I did is, I of all the discipline cases that we do a final order in every year, for the last 4 years, you can see it averages there in about the mid-70s. That's 0.2% of all the employed licensed educators that we have in the state. So what happens is we get a very public case or a public incident, and I think people think a lot is going on, and actually, in actual fact, this is what the evidence has proved this year, the cases that we could close. And I just thought you might also be interested in knowing the number of new cases that are reported annually, and for the last 4 years, that number is in the second column there on the table. And that's also fairly consistent. But to be very quick and brief, the concerns that we have about the bill, and Ms. Nesbitt can give you more details about how we handle these cases, are that these are cases that must and need to be investigated by law enforcement and not school districts. And we already have it does not take much for somebody to innocently, permanently jeopardize a case or a conviction by doing an investigation in these very sensitive cases. So I think the bill is extremely well-intentioned. The features that we really like, however, are that the districts turn over the materials that would be related to anything around the incident. But we generally don't have a problem with this, frankly. They're very accommodating. But I also put in my testimony, it presents an opportunity for us, and you could help us, and that is that there's a statute that I've attached to one of the pieces of material that I gave you. It's at the bottom. It's ORS 181-525, I believe. And it says that law courts and district attorney's offices will turn over final cases in these cases to TSPC when they know the person involved has been an educator. And this is unevenly enforced throughout the state, and we do call and we do form relationships, but anything you can give us to help us kind of make that a little more well enforced would be appreciated. But the other one that would also be significant and would help us is in ORS 419B-035. That's a statute that protects the confidentiality of records related to child abuse. And in that very first section of the, and I'm sorry, I intended to bring the statute for you so you could look at it, and I left it in the copy machine. So my apologies. But in the, it lists a, it's a protect, they're protected records, which makes sense, but there's a list of bodies that are eligible to receive the reports from the Department of Human Services when they've done investigations around child abuse. And if TSPC could be in that list, it would save us an enormous amount of time and money, because we now have to go through our AG to go and negotiate with DHS to get these reports, and sometimes we get them and sometimes we don't. So I saw this as an opportunity, because it appears to me that you want to help us get our job done in those rare instances where we need to do something.
Thank you. And we'll hear from Ms. Nesbitt, and then we'll have questions from the panel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Nesbitt. I'm the investigator for Teacher Standards and Practices Commission.
Would you like to make any comment?
I didn't have any. I understood that I was here by invitation.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you, I think.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Lim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a good year, but what I have a concern, there has been an incident that the student wrongly accused the teacher because the person didn't like the teacher or the way teacher disciplined her or the credit, whatever, has not been what the person wanted, and things happen. And how do we make sure that the not only just watching the teachers and the employees report it, but make sure how could we get that message across to the students? You know, if they are wrongly accused the teacher, that's a grave consequences is going to follow them. Because today we passed out from the House floor that the Teachers Appreciation Day, the second Tuesday of May, and we need to respect the teacher, but the way some students behave is not the best, sir.
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, Teacher Standards and Practices has no authority over a student's behavior. Our venue is licensed educators or licensed educators. Making a false report is a crime in Oregon.
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, I also would like to add, we have processes and procedures that protect innocent educators. And you'll see the number of new cases as opposed to the final orders. Our records, if the investigator determines there is not any evidence here for this accusation, she brings a recommendation forward to me, which I take to the commission, that we not charge the educator. And if the educator isn't ever charged and nothing ever comes of that, those records are permanently by statute to remain confidential. And the intent is to protect people from those type of charges, and we try to be extremely careful about names and what we say about reports we get into the office. And so I have to say that in the 3 years that I've been here, the evidence the investigators have brought forward has been very clear in the cases that we've made decisions in, and that when there isn't evidence, the commission does not forge ahead.
Thank you.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question regarding the timeline, because I noticed that one of the proposed amendments to the bill, line 4, any district that receives a report or complaint that a district employee has abused a child shall suspend the district employee from duty with pay until either the district determines that the report is unsubstantiated or that the report complaint is substantiated. So in all of these discipline cases, how long did it take you to determine whether or not that teacher was at fault or not?
Madam Chair, Representative Barr, I can't see very well. In almost all of the cases I pursue in which there appears some reasonable validity in the complaint, the educator is no longer employed. The contract, the educator's contract with the district would have a clause in it for how many days of paid administrative leave they're placed on during their investigation at the district or the local law enforcement level. So this issue with reference to the commission's investigation and how long the teacher's on administrative leave, they're really not in the same areas. One's a labor issue and one's a licensure issue.
And Madam Chair, Representative Farr, another thing I think I heard in your question, just to give you an idea, is that we really must wait if there's any criminal matter happening until that criminal matter is concluded fully, mm-hmm. which could involve appeals. And so I have, in my tenure here, actually had to deal with cases that are sometimes 3 and 4 years old. But as Ms. Nesbitt indicated, these folks are never employed during that period. Districts just have been well trained not to take the risk. But for us, it it sort of looks bad because we get a report and 4 years later we take action, but we really do need to wait for the criminal matter to be resolved if it is in the criminal courts.
May I ask a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So, Ben, are you telling me that you could have suspended a teacher with pay for 4 years, and at the end of 4 years, that teacher is found to be innocent of all the charges?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I suppose that is a possibility. There are other things that happen, fair dismissals, board actions, where sometimes those things are resolved. But the criminal folks rarely take that long. If it's going to take that long, that means there's been a conviction, because the state's not going to appeal if they lose, and that the convicted person is then appealing. So it is just I don't know of districts that suspend with pay for that long. There's generally, they risk the employment issue on the side of not paying.
So then may I ask a further follow-up? So would you say that the normal time would be like 3 to 6 months before the issue is resolved?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I would say that the normal time is around 30 days.
Okay. Great. Good point. Now, I probably just didn't ask my question the right way because it took 2 follow-ups to get the answer that I wanted. I'm going to work on that.
Representative Froblin and Representative Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill, still, there's another requirement that's not in this bill, and that is that the employee who notices this has to report it to another law enforcement officer. And I worried about that when I read this. And the other issue that I have is that you have, in fact, suspended licenses for people who may have been not found not guilty in a trial. Is that not the case? So, I mean, it isn't just the trial case. You do a separate investigation.
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I brought you our rules for your reading convenience. I know you have nothing else to do. But one of the statutes, and the statute I gave you, 342.143, says that we can make determinations based on good moral character and fitness to teach. And it's an excellent question because if you watch Law and Order, it's a great example. District attorneys negotiate all the time, depending on whether they want to spend the cost on trial or whatever. And so people may not be convicted, or they may agree or settle to a lesser crime or not, or the district attorney office may decide not to proceed at invest the resources on that criminal issue. It may still be egregious enough to us that we don't want that educator around children. So that's generally how we weigh the issue.
Representative?
Yes, there's a couple of points I'd like to make. We heard the term 4 years, and I believe you straightened that out. Most of these are handled very rapidly, 30 days. But when there is an error or someone suspended with pay, we're erring not on the side of the employee but on the side of the child. We're protecting children on the off chance. And I think that has to be put into the record, that the issue is to protect the child. We'll pay the teacher, and if they are innocent, that's a terrible miscarriage of justice. But if we've protected the child, it's worth the risk.
Madam Chair, Representative Dallin, my follow-up is that I think I was speaking about things that come in our office and go through our door, and you were coming from the district and the person in that situation. So, true apples and oranges.
That's okay. We have a lot of that in the legislature.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, this bill is written for the district. I mean, it's really about the individual district making a decision to take care of this very quickly. And your input really comes at the end of that, but they have to notify you. Are there situations that you know of where districts have gone through and fired people over these kind of things and not notified you? I mean, found out later.
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, yes.
Okay.
There are, and we have a reporting requirement statute, and that I actually did run into that in the last 4 years. Not often, but it will result in generally a reprimand, which is public, on the license. However, I do have to say administrators are extremely accountable, and for lots of reasons, but I mean for very good reasons, and I think it's not that difficult an issue for almost all of them.
Representative Mark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to reconcile the bill with the reporting requirements under 419B005. And it seems to me that under the existing reporting of child abuse, any school employee is required to notify both the law enforcement and the Department of Human Services. Says report to law enforcement agencies and local office of the Department of Human Services. And it seems to me that this might create a confusion in that we're now telling the school employees that they're supposed to report it to the district. Are we creating a conflict here, or are we, is this supposed to be an additional report? I'm not sure.
Representative Dolan, you want to address it?
I believe what we have is, and I'm going to look to my colleague, Representative Roblin, what you're reading from Representative March is what an employee must do if they suspect child abuse from their position working with the student. What our legal, what the new legislation is asking for is that if an employee of the district suspects child abuse by another employee, they must report it. So I think we have two different things working here.
Yeah. Well, I think
Representative Roland.
Thank you. And part of that clarification, I think there can be an issue of conflict. I believe that an employee, if they suspected another employee, has an obligation to notify the police, regardless. I mean, I think that's inherent in the current law, that we must do that. Also inherent in the other law is that they don't have to notify the administrator. That is not the requirement of the law. There is no requirement that you notify the district. So you can keep yourself out of that. You have to notify police. And I always thought it was human services or police. Either one works because they get together and deal with it. So that's why I was differing with him. I think this is a separate requirement that would be in specific cases, you know, where it's a person's thing. So they would be required to notify the police and the district in this particular case, as I read this. Is that how?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, since there were so many questions, I think you're absolutely correct. The district may have a policy that would require the educator to report to their supervisor. Most of them do, but you would be putting in statute the requirement that districts have the policies to make sure that happens, and that is probably definitely a change. And it is definitely my understanding that you must report to one or the other, Department of Human Services or law enforcement, but that if you do suspect child abuse, regardless who does it, a colleague or a parent or someone else, you're obligated to report.
Are you squared away, Representative March?
Well, I still have some questions with the particular bill and how it might function in with regard and what we're adding to this other than letting the district know. So this is something I'm going to have to look at a little more, I think. Thanks.
I do have a couple questions we can run down, and I'll direct them to Ms. Nisbet and or Ms. Chamberlain. Did the Oregon Department of Education, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and the school boards, school districts all use the same criteria for evaluating criminal convictions for employment?
I would. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the answer is no. We all have different standards, and I am going to tell you what I believe ODE does based on a conversation I had with them, but you will want to ask them. The Department of Education screens the non-licensed educators, and we fingerprint and do background checks on the licensed educators. And it's my understanding that the Department of Education screens only on the crimes that are listed in the what we call the mandatory crimes, the crimes that are it's mandatory that we not employ them or not license them. And in the FAT document I gave you, they're on pages 9 and 10. actually 8, 9, and 10. They're the murder, the kidnapping, the rape, the sex abuse, the robbery, treason, prostitution. That's actually an issue in a Senate bill. Furnishing obscene materials to minors, etc. My point here is that unless you're convicted of one of those, the Department of Education check then wouldn't be looking at other arrests or convictions. They wouldn't be relevant to them. Those other arrests and convictions, drinking and driving, drug possession, anything, would be relevant to us, and therefore that makes the standards different. I have no idea what districts use when they are actually sometimes do require another background check. So,
okay. If an applicant has been convicted of assault, is there a way to determine or is there a determination made as to whether that conviction for assault has been against an adult or a child?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, first of all, I have questions about how we are to determine that someone was convicted of assault if they're applying for a position in a school district. The only method that the commission is required to review by law is fingerprint records. Now, I don't know what your understanding is of fingerprint records, but if I were arrested for assault in my county and convicted, they wouldn't have fingerprinted me. They know who I am. And they probably wouldn't have incarcerated me, so I wouldn't have been fingerprinted. There's no obligation by the counties or the cities to fingerprint anyone on an arrest unless it's for a felony. And a jail has a policy usually that they'll fingerprint anyone they incarcerate. So fingerprint records would be the basis or the criteria for to determine whether or not someone has been convicted for an arrest, but that's not a complete criminal record for any individual in this state.
Do records, is there background checks or records from other states that are used in considering a teacher for employment in Oregon?
I do not. The commission does not have access to other states' fingerprint records. I sincerely, seriously doubt that any school district would.
Madam Chair, members of the record, to round that out slightly more, we wouldn't have, if that happened, the situation where they weren't fingerprinted, Susan wasn't fingerprinted and she was convicted of assault. In this state, we do have access to the court records. That's one protection. But we also, on our application, require people to disclose, and they often don't. But it's a tiny state, and we often find out. And that's actually grounds for revocation just for falsifying the application. It's not upfront insurance, but it is often ultimate other insurance. The other piece of the information is that we're required to turn fingerprints into Oregon State Police and the FBI. And actually, that is nearly not state police so much, but FBI is haphazard, as Ms. Nisbet was suggesting, because not every state turns their records into the FBI. But it is actually the best system we have. And the FBI check is what often turns up our major out-of-state crimes. And the final thing I want to be absolutely sure you understand is that if an educator has been licensed in another state and they have been disciplined, we're actually very well organized on that front, state to state. And we have a national list that which we keep current in our records to check when we get applicants who've been licensed in other states to check. So it's not foolproof, and it's been an issue all along, but I think it works fairly well.
In that context, Ms. Chamberlain, you do have a list of educators, both teachers and administrators, that have had action taken against them. Is that public record?
Madam Chair, yes, it is public record. We're required by law to post it publicly by March 1st. It's on our webpage under our publications. Under our publications, I'm almost certain it's a discipline list, and I can get copies to Mr. Keller for you quite easily. I have one I've written on, but I'll get him a clean one.
I did want to answer your question, whether or not we do check. I obtain police reports in all cases I'm aware of to determine whether or not it's a child or an adult in which the assault is committed.
But you're limited by that you're aware of. Yeah.
do you think it would be helpful if there was some coordinated criteria amongst the entities, ODE and school districts? And
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, the commission has the most possibilities for resources of information than either one of the other two. We have Department of Corrections databases available to us in our office, Department of Motor Vehicles. Believe it or not, we get a lot of information from that. The department, state criminal history, fingerprint records, and OJIN, the Oregon Judicial Information Network. So we're making all kinds of efforts, and we have all kinds of resources, and I feel like we have an expert researcher in our office.
Would that be you?
No. That would not.
Well, I thought maybe. Are school administrators qualified to evaluate applicants to ensure that their background doesn't create a risk to students?
Madam Chair, I'd like to think if we've cleared them, they're more than the district is more than protected in hiring them. The only thing that can happen is that something can happen between when we've granted the license and they're seeking employment. So in other words, we wouldn't have awareness of it. Every time an educator renews, we run a background check. We don't re-fingerprint them, but we do check. And most educators are honest and disclose, and we handle it that way. But I would say yes. I think administrators have a lot to do as it is, and that's why we try to keep our system as tight as it can so they can trust that the license has been checked and the person has been checked, and they should be able to rely on that. Other than the interim, I think, is the only issue.
Do all the school districts report to you as they are required to do?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no, not all, but certainly most. And when we occasionally discover they have not, we discover it's a misunderstanding about what they thought it was they needed to report.
Do you know if all school districts perform background checks individually?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, your largest school districts actually have a whole staffing unit that takes care of background, and they do backgrounds. Most schools that I've had conversations with, the building principals, the individual building principals, do background investigations. I travel around the state to teach building principals how to conduct background investigations. It's part of my job description. It's part of the work that I enjoy a great deal.
Is there any distinction between an applicant within a school district here in Oregon from an Oregon applicant as opposed to an out-of-state applicant?
Many of the school administrators and building principals call me when they want to hire an out-of-state applicant, and I simply make a phone call to my counterpart in that state.
I see. To your knowledge, all school districts in Oregon have resources to identify sex abuse, physical abuse, sexual predators, and assaultive behavior?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, to my knowledge, almost all school districts do not have the resources for that. They do not have any employee who works for them that is trained to conduct an investigation of child abuse or physical abuse. Yesterday, I interviewed the superintendent of a small school district locally. He told me that if such a thing were required, they would have to have their attorney conduct that investigation, and it would cost them thousands of dollars to have that investigation done because they have no one on staff. When I started this job 8 years, 2 months, and 28 days ago,
who's counting?
I do. I could not believe that building principals, who are responsible for the safety of our children, didn't know what an investigation consisted of, didn't know how to begin an investigation, didn't know what the definition of child abuse was. And so I looked around and I thought, well, what's wrong with the programs? Why are these certification programs not including that component? I didn't know why. But when I went to BPST, which is at that time was the Bureau of Police Standards and Practices.
Thank you.
They told me that, sure, Susan, we'll give you the curriculum. You're a certified officer. We'll give you the curriculum. curriculum, and then they wanted to know the membership of my class and the BPST numbers of those people. And I said, well, they're not police officers. And they said, Susan, we won't give you this curriculum. This is only for law enforcement. So I had to devise my own type of class to present, you know, write the curriculum and then go out and present it. And I travel all over the state and do that when invited. Other than that, I know of no place where a school administrator could acquire the skills and the techniques to conduct an investigation.
And in either of your opinions, are there other behaviors in school districts that we should be addressing, such as alcohol and or drug abuse?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think districts are actually handling those issues very, very well. And frankly, judging by the numbers of the reports in this area, I would say they're really on it and not tolerant of that behavior. I don't have the exact data, but I'm willing to gamble quite a bit. The highest incidence of alcohol abuse or use is the highest incidence of problems caused for reports we get related to educators. But as you see, the numbers aren't giant in all our numbers. The numbers I gave you carved out, you know, a certain percent for these other totally unrelated issues. And I don't think the districts need additional regulation. It feels to me they're handling it quite well. And just so that you know, when we get those cases, if they have substance abuse or I think we had a new term, substance abuse issues is I think what we call it. We don't go so far as calling it addiction. There's generally two or three arrests, a couple of drunk drivings, a record, something like that. And we ask that the educators get treatment and then produce reports through a probationary period that they are following the treatment that has been suggested. And the protection there is if the person doesn't have a substance abuse issue, they won't be referred to treatment and they won't be recommended for treatment. And so that's helpful information also. Does that help?
It does. Thank you. I think one last question. Relatively recent news, there's a man being held in Tennessee who was from the Salem-Keizer area and being held for sexual abuse, child abuse issues. Did you have any knowledge of that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that individual has been extradited, you'll be happy to know, and is currently in the Marion County Jail and is being prosecuted by the Marion County District Attorney's Office, and I'm in contact by letter with the Deputy District Attorney who's prosecuting that case.
Was there any concern when he was in Salem-Keizer?
I don't have that information.
Lives that were raised at that time?
I don't have that information at this time, right this second.
Okay. Thank you. And I see a hand waving. Representative Roblin.
Yeah, a couple things. One is a comment, one and another one is a question. Because you were asking about administrators, I will tell you that from this principal standpoint, the police actually, and I was happy to hear that, the police actually said, that's not your job. Don't do an investigation. It is not your job. Your job is to, when anything is heard, and you're not even supposed to test whether you think it rises to any level. That's not your job. We investigate. It's our job. DHS and them, and we have people that are trained to do it. You know, we'll keep you informed and whatever as much as we can, but you just reporting. And, you know, our job was to teach staff and other people on the deal to report. You know, don't second guess yourself, don't think, don't try to come up with a reason why maybe it's not true. They will figure that out. And to the credit of both the police that I've worked with, they take it very seriously. They do investigations. Sometimes they decide that either there's nothing to it, and other times they decide there is. And when they do, they go after it the way they're supposed to. And I just want to give a compliment to TSPC. You don't always agree at times because you don't know what's going on, but they are doggedly determined to do the right thing and to follow it through to the very end. And usually they're right, even if you're a long way. So I have seen some of the investigations that you have done, and I appreciate the work they do. And No, I don't have the training that it takes to do the things that they do. And I appreciate the fact that the state has made an important part of what we do to try to keep kids safe. We want to teach kids, and we don't think about those things. There are other people who are really good at it. And I think the way we set it up right now, if people just follow it, if they just believe it when they say, if you hear something, it doesn't sound, it sounds fishy or whatever, go report it. I mean, it doesn't hurt. You have anonymity with regard to that. And people who are trained to ferret that out will do that. So I appreciate the work you do, and
our overriding concern is for the protection and safety of our children. So thank you very much,
thank
ladies.
Thank you.
Okay. Pondier, Sar, and I probably really did you a disservice.
We're doing a group thing up here.
Everybody added a different letter.
I will clarify for you that name is Fulvier and last name Slick. I'm Jan Slick with Family Based Services, Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. I'm here on behalf of Una Swanson, who is our Child Protective Services Program Manager. She was called to testify in another hearing, so I'm going to do my best to replace her. The department is opposed to 3169 as it is currently written. We certainly support the concept of the bill, and we support school districts in taking additional steps to formalize a process that would ensure child safety. You have already discussed some of the concerns that we have about this bill. Representative Marsh alluded to confusion or conflict around the bills calling for immediately reporting child abuse allegations by school employees as opposed to the mandatory reporting statute, which also calls for school employees to report to either the department or to law enforcement. And we are, of course, concerned about potential for delay in reporting, which would affect the investigation or DHS's ability to protect children. We are also concerned about language in the bill that calls for investigation by the school district, recognizing that that does not differentiate from the investigation that would be carried out by law enforcement and the department. And again, as Representative Roplin pointed out, we have law enforcement and child protective service workers who are trained in investigation. And then we have a final concern that has to do with the bill requiring that when requested, a substantiated report would be disclosed to the public. We have concerns about the potential for that to put victims at further harm, and also that an untimely release of information could jeopardize law enforcement's investigation and prosecution. Again, we support the concept behind House Bill 3169 and would be happy to work with the sponsors to amend language. So with that, I thank you for the opportunity to testify and would be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Slick, Representative Clark?
I have a question for you, and please forgive me if this was stated earlier today, but I've been having a side conversation with Representative Roblin. And what if, would you support the bill if it required the school district or the school where the child abuse was suspected to keep some kind of record? I think that, the spirit of the bill makes sense to me because, as Representative Roblin said, while the employee is expected to contact an agency, there's no follow-through to know that they actually have. So what about a record that would show that this abuse was suspected and then the appropriate agency was contacted?
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, we certainly would support the school keeping a record that a report was made. We do encourage mandatory reporters to keep their own records when they make report, in addition, obviously, to the documentation that we keep.
So follow up.
So
you require them to keep their own report, and then what happens to that report?
I'm Chair Flores, Representative Farr. When the department receives a report, an allegation of abuse, we keep records of the reports that we receive. We also recommend that mandatory reporters keep their own information that they have made a report. It's not a requirement that we have, but we certainly recommend that they do keep that information for their own protection.
And so that would be something that if I was making the report, I would keep in my own personal records.
We would encourage you to keep some record on your own that you've made a report and the content of that report.
Follow-up. If I may, my point, though, was what about a record that was kept at the school where the allegation against the employee was made?
Chair Flores and Representative Farr, I could see no reason we would object to that. It makes sense that they would do that.
Thank you. Any additional questions for Ms. Slick? Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had sort of a tangential question in that kind of understand your agency has got a pretty heavy workload, and there have been a number of cases where children were being abused in homeschooled situations, and I put a bill together that would require students as wardens of the state to go to a public school or some school with the mandatory reporting requirements that are in the current law. Do you have any thoughts on that concept?
I think you're over my head there.
Okay.
You're getting a hearing on your bill here.
Well, I mean, we're so close, so close, and I noticed the nexus here.
Yeah.
But the other part of the question, if I'll follow up on that, is TSCP mentioned adding them to the reports that go back and forth. Do you have any problem with that?
Chair Flores, Representative Marsh, I see no reason we would object to that.
Thank you.
Representative Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you see a concern in the way this bill is written? A number of staff have a difficulty making the report in the first place, and we continue to make sure that they do it. Now they would be required to make it to two people, one to DHS, one to the school. Do you see that as a hindrance that maybe they wouldn't call either? I mean, I worry about that at times, that I can call this anonymous person and tell them, and they're going to keep me anonymous, but if I tell somebody else at the building, it's a problem.
Chair Flores, Representative Roebling, I appreciate that concern. I guess I can't really answer for someone. I can say that having worked in protective services for a number of years, that we have, under current statute, experienced many situations where, because of school protocols that employees report to the principal, that the employee will report to the principal rather than to the department, and that has been problematic. So, again, that's one of the reasons we have concerns about this bill and the potential to confuse that further. But again, as to whether an employee would prefer to report to to be anonymous in making their report, I sort of makes sense to me. But I can't speak for someone in deciding to make a report.
Are we satisfied, Representative Lim?
So, to me, this bill makes sense that the before. Is being reported maybe at the same time, the school could be a clearing house, whether that the accused is actually real things or not. Mm-hmm. And if it's not, then there's no need to go further. But if there's a substantiated allegation found to be true, then it could be processed according to the law. So to me, that the school should be a self-governing body, and the school district, and that should be a good clearing house for that issue.
Chair Flores, Representative Lim, I'm not sure I entirely understand your intent there. What I can say is that, at least for the department, that we depend on the expertise that law enforcement has in doing their investigations to contact all of the parties that they would feel are appropriate in making their best determination about whether the allegations are true or not. So depending on what they find within the course of the investigation, I would think that they might well contact and talk to school personnel.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Did you have a question?
Please.
Representative Dahl.
I'm trying to get a sense for how many cases of child abuse originate in the school. If you do 10 cases where you suspect child abuse, how many of them have their first tip from somebody in the school system?
Chair Flores, Representative Gollum, I should know that, but I'm afraid I don't have that information. I do remember that a significant number of reporters are school personnel, but as to the percentage, I would have to get that information.
But it is significant.
It is significant for school-aged children, obviously. But as I remember, school personnel are the most likely source of report for children who are school age.
Thank you very much, Ms.
Certainly.
Lee. I do need to, for the record, indicate that Julie H. McFarlane from Juvenile Rights Project has submitted some testimony. I would like to call your attention to page 2 of her testimony, wherein two hypothetical questions were addressed to educators. The second hypothetical question, the teachers were asked if they would make a report when a student tells them that another teacher was touching their genitals. Only 26% of the teachers said they would report the first instance to the authorities, and only 11% said they would report the second incident to the authorities. And also, this group does have concerns with the bill, but I thought those statistics were edifying. So. Sir.
Chair, do you know the background of that research? I mean, some states, I don't think, have the mandatory reporting requirement. And if that's 197 teachers throughout the United States, it may not apply to Oregon.
Kenny, Maureen Kenny, Child Abuse Reporting, Teachers Perceive Deterrence, 25 Child Abuse and Neglect, 81.
That's a citation.
It's a citation.
So that's a journal,
so
yeah, so we'll have to,
search that out a little bit.
Thanks.
Uh-huh. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3169. And we will open immediately a public hearing on House Bill 183. We will call John Marshall and Ann Hannis.
House Bill 3183 changes method for distribution of income from common school fund to school districts.
Mr. Marshall.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon again. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. And thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for introducing this bill. This is an issue that we have worked on during the interim, and bring this bill forward to accomplish two things. One, to streamline and speed up distributions from the Common School Fund to school districts. And two, to make sure those distributions are run through the Department of Education as local revenue, so these folks over there can have more accurate estimates of this source of local revenue for purposes of distributing the rest of the state school fund accurately out to school districts. I've enclosed for you a brochure that's prepared by the Department of State Lands, hereinafter referred to as DSL, about the Common School Fund, a trust fund that was established at statehood and has become an ever-increasing source of revenue to local school districts. What House Bill 3183 does is remove what we believe is a rather circuitous and time-consuming route from the earnings on that trust fund to school districts and speed that up. I prepared a copy of a chart, and I apologize. I can get my computer to do some things, but other things, it's not very cooperative.
I love it.
The Common School Fund is held in trust, and the earnings on that fund are distributed twice a year to school districts. The earnings of the fund are placed in what's called the distributable income account, and that's an account that's held until those distributions are made out to Oregon's 198 school districts. The current statutory process requires the Department of State Lands to apportion that distributable income account out to Oregon's 36 counties based on the number of resident children residing in those counties between the ages of 4 and 20, and that's a constitutional requirement. The dollars then, apportioned by county, go out, as you can see, to the county treasurer. The county treasurer holds those funds. The data of the county apportionment goes to the administrative office of the county, which is the ESD, or excuse me, Education Service District.
The Education Service District then determines the average daily membership of the school districts within those counties, because that's the basis on which those funds go back to the school districts. Once the administrative office of the county determines that apportionment, they send that information back to the county treasurer, and then the county treasurer makes the dollar distribution out to school districts within the county. Now, that obviously we believe is very circuitous. It's time consuming, and what we're trying to do is relieve this rather archaic duty of the county treasurer. If you'll turn it over, we see the result of House Bill 3183. The Department of State Lands will send the distributable income account, or the amount of the distributable income account, to the Superintendent of Public Instruction. The Superintendent of Public Instruction, by statute, is required to receive the estimates of the number of resident children ages 4 to 20. The Superintendent of Public Instruction and the Department of Education already have the average daily membership numbers from school districts. From there, that the dollars would go immediately to school districts. This can all be done through wire transfer now, and it would be almost immediate. The department would have the data, simply wait on the income from the Common School Fund to come from the Department of State Land and immediately get it out to school districts. That, in effect, is the purpose of the bill. We think this represents government efficiency and economy, and would encourage you to advance it. I understand it has a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee, so as soon as you can move that forward, the happier we would be. And I thank you very much again for helping us get this before you.
Thank you. Chair Flores, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ann Hannis, Director, Department of State Lands. We support this bill. It's a common sense bill that streamlines the process, and I believe that the quicker we can get the money to schools, the better. In a time when we can electronically transfer funds, the language in the current statute is antiquated, and I think it's time to change it so we can get that money as quickly as possible out to schools.
Thank you. Are there questions for either of our panelists?
I have a small question.
Representative Lynn.
Yes, the county treasurer, do they charge any money when they transfer the money to the school district?
I'm sorry, Representative Lynn, could you repeat, please?
Okay, thank you. Do they charge when they transfer this money to the school district?
The county treasurer.
Representative Lynn, they're not supposed to.
Not supposed
so they don't.
Okay.
Are we sure?
Might live off the interest.
We're very hopeful, Madam Chair.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You say the Constitution requires it by count to be apportioned by county, and that's why we go through this instead of having to just go to just ADN by district.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Are there additional questions? Representative Roblin.
I can ask that question that they were leading to. Now, the money that the counties are saving by not having to do this, will they send that back to the Common School Fund? No, I
Representative Roblin, we'd be happy to work on an amendment.
Okay.
Or it might be a reallocation of resources for some of the other bills that they're testifying on. Any additional questions?
Madam Chair, excuse me, if I could, I have shared this idea with the county treasurer. I've shared this idea with the Department of Education, the governor's office, and the secretary of state. Those three statewide elected officials are the trustees of the Common School Fund serving on the land board. So I have not heard back that they have any objections. So
no, the land board does support this on behalf of the land board.
Thank you very much. I'm quite glad that your computer didn't make it look pretty, because it does go to an efficiency statement here, and a picture is worth a thousand words. So do you expect any response from the other members of the Common School Fund that would have any weight bearing on this? You expect that they're supportive of doing this?
Madam Chair, we have a group of what I'll call the usual suspects, the education advocates that have formed the Common School Fund Beneficiaries Coalition, and they are all supportive of this change.
Great. Representative Roblin.
So the Department of Ed is looks forward to this? Have you talked?
I shared Representative Roblin the concept with the Department of Education, and I haven't heard back from them.
We just got a thumbs up.
The official language of today. Thank you very much.
Thank
and
you.
We will be moving on the next available opportunity to get this to a work session. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3183. No more business to come before this committee. We will stand adjourned at precisely 3 p.m.